Hi, I'm Heidi Zuckerman, and this is Conversations About Art, a podcast that talks about art in contemporary culture and why we should care. Each episode will focus on how art connects to the lives of people I find interesting. Artists, collectors, curators, athletes, actors, musicians, politicians, CEOs, and people who I think you'll find interesting too. Our first episode features athlete, collector, and entrepreneur Lance Armstrong. When you say the name Lance Armstrong, there are no doubt a ton of associations that people have. Mine are perhaps different in that he is a long-term, close personal friend, but also we were introduced through art. We also share a common interest in and commitment to artists of our time. I decided to launch my podcast with a conversation with Lance because the first podcast I was on was his, The Forward. But more importantly, one of my core beliefs is that connecting people to art and artists makes their lives better. Lance is a key example of someone whose life in times of great duress has been improved by his connection to art. So, thanks for talking with me today giving me my podcast 101 training.
I'm returning the favor.
So you are. I loved being on your podcast.
Thank you.
You made it super easy for me. And you had all these notes and you had read my book. And so I don't have notes, but I have them in my head. So I wanted...
You're a lot smarter than me. So when you barely squeak out of high school, you have to do a little more studying and take more notes.
You know, I think being prepared and being over-prepared is really important. So I think everyone should do that.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk to you today about art and uncertainty. So that's what I'm focused on today.
Yeah.
So tell me just a little bit about how you first came to art, because that we knew each other socially, and the first time that I was really kind of interested was when you talked to me about why you liked art and what you thought artists did and how it related to what you've done.
Yep. So I think it's really three things. The first and probably the most importantly is when I got out of high school, I went to Europe. I didn't go to college. I didn't get a job in America. I went to Europe to race bikes. And so I had this crash course on culture and architecture, art, food, language, people. And so that was, I was just observing this, and I was a white trash kid from Plano, Texas, who, you know, to me, art growing up was Motley Crue posters on the wall. By the way, great documentary on Netflix, but about Motley Crue.
Yes.
And so it started there. That was kind of the first phase. And then the second really was when I built my first home, and I hired an interior designer, and, you know, obviously they pick out couches and chairs and dining tables and bedside tables and, you know, paint colors, all of these things that they pick out. And then a lot of them will say, you know, we'll pick out some art for the walls. And and at that moment, it just struck me like, wait a minute. Like, it feels like the walls ought to be mine. Like, I don't want to pick out, I want to be involved in picking out all of those other things, but it feels like the walls need to not just be something that a designer, as good as they are, just goes and buys at some random place that, you know, that doesn't have a story, and somebody walks in and is like, oh my God, I love that piece. And you're like, yeah, my designer found it somewhere and that didn't feel right. So like, give me the walls. And so I just started to buy art. And then the third and final thing is the guy who owned our team at the time was a major, it was a financier from San Francisco, major collector. And we would always have team events at his house or houses. And he just had incredible art. And so, you know, I was like, holy cow. And just to see, you know, big, famous, expensive, beautiful art, I was like, okay, this is, I get it. In my own simple way, right? And so that was really the three-step process to getting into art.
So do you remember the first artist that you met?
The first artist I met, it probably would have been with the owner of our team. I can't remember. I mean, the one that I remember meeting the most, mm-hmm. you know, fondly and had the most impact on me, which was probably 12 years ago, was Ed Richey. And managed to create a relationship and a friendship with him that's just gotten deeper and deeper. And but that was really the, you know, and a lot of other great artists along the way, but Ed's one that, he was always my favorite artist. He was always the one that I wanted to meet the most and always the one that I wanted to be able to collect, right? And so then I had a print or very early on, Safe and Effective Medication, mm-hmm. which had many meanings. and then I was able later on as in my career to buy, to buy great pieces.
So he is an artist that I really admire as well and have always loved the work. And we had him come to Aspen. And I remember the work that he made for your 40th birthday.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And what drew you to the work? What sustained your interest? One of the things I like about it is text mm. and how he uses text. But I wonder if that's what it is for you as well.
I think it's... Well, first of all, he's basically a Southern boy, so I always appreciated that as I came from Texas. I think the thing, if I had to pick one word, is his humor. Mm-hmm. He's very, and I don't know that everybody gets it, but I get it, and I've been around him enough to know that he's just a funny guy, and so he's irreverent, and he's so successful, now he just doesn't care. So he has no guardrails, no boundaries. He just sort of does what he wants. And yeah, I'm also a fan of just that simple. I don't need it. It's so simple sometimes that it's amazing. And, you know, the birthday card is a great example. I mean, he writes, and you've seen it, of course, we're doing an audio show here, but he writes, he spells out four in his classic block lettering and then O. O, H, 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 and the H's just keep getting smaller and smaller, meaning, you know, you might just be turning to the back nine of your life, right? And so it takes a good friend to say, hey, buddy, you know, have fun in the second half when, you know, you could have been given that to somebody that swore they were going to live to 120.
Right.
But that's just, it's a bit dark, not a bit dark. I mean, I think there's a lot of darkness in his dark and dark humor in his work, and I just love it. I love it.
So one of my favorite things about you is your sense of humor, and I don't know if this is an okay story to tell, but I remember when we were in Cuba and we were like swimming, we were in the pool, we were kind of hanging out, and you said like, okay, just so everyone knows, it just got warm over here. I was like, God.
Yeah, you know, the water is all of a sudden 98.6 degrees. It's the most fucked up thing. I don't know what just happened. In a slightly different color. Mm-hmm. You know, I will expand on that story because Anna and the kids, you know, I grew up a swimmer. And I've always maintained that the best swimmers in the world, when they're in the middle of an intense workout, they just pee in the pool. And Anna would always, no way, that's disgusting. They would never... I said, and I've managed to strike up, and hopefully I'm not crossing any boundaries with him, but I've managed to strike up this relationship with Michael Phelps. And I said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And so we sent him, we were in Nantucket this summer, and we sent him a video. Like I recorded myself after like 38,000 glasses of rosé that day. I sent him, I was like, dude, you're the best. You're the best of all time. I got to know. And he sent us a video back going, yeah, middle of a hard set. And that you got, just let it go. So I don't feel bad about that.
No, you should not feel bad about that. And I could actually take this one step further, but I'm going to, you know, change direction.
Okay.
So,
I thought we were talking about art. Why are we talking about peeing in pools?
I know. Well, it's, I think we're talking about humor.
Yeah.
So, you and I both like the artist, Rob Pruitt.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a really memorable time where you wanted one of his works. It was up at an Aspen Art Museum auction at Art Crush.
Yep.
And can you tell that story?
Well, before I tell the story, it's just never good to get in a one-on-one contest with a billionaire at an art auction.
That is true.
It was never ending. I was like, I want John. We'll just call him John. I was like, dude, I want this piece. And he just kept going higher and higher. I'm like,
And I was sitting next to him and he's like, who's bidding against me?
Right.
Like, stand up and look.
And I could see that, by the way, that piece in their home here or their other homes I've seen them, that would be, that's right in line with their style and their taste. It would be amazing. But title of the piece was Sweet Revenge, which, you know, for me, this was an interesting, this would have been, was this August of 2012? Mm-hmm. This was August. So my world sort of slowly started to crumble. June of 12 really started to crumble. July of 12 and then August into October just, you know, eviscerated. And so I was, if the title was you know, Cats and Dogs, right, I still would have loved the piece. I mean, visually, it's incredible. It's big. The colors are vibrant, dynamic. But then when you layer in, you know, and in my mind in 2012, I'm like, okay, I know that at this moment, I'm completely fucked. But I'm not going to lay down. I'm not going to curl up in a fetal position. I'm not going to, you know, beg for mercy. I'm gonna hide out, hug my kids, stay fit, stay focused, and eventually work again. And so, you know, revenge is a big word. I mean, revenge is a, and some can take it as almost a mean or an evil word. But it's for me, it was just simply about getting back into the world. And so, you know, I mean, and it's, I think to a large degree, some of that's happened. Maybe not, you know, it's still happening, but. And I'm not trying to rub whatever small amount of success I've been able to recreate in anybody's face, but it does feel a little bit like revenge. And it look, being able to create content and build an audience again is you know, when you combine the two words, it's sweet.
Yeah.
And so yeah.
And
that it's hanging up here in the house in Aspen now.
Yeah, and it's a big, beautiful, bold painting, yeah. And it has almost the colors of a rainbow from yeah. sort of the top to the bottom. Right. And on top of that, which, you know, also references like rock posters from the 70s right. and, you know, but it has kind of a hand-drawn sort of smiley face yeah. And the figure, you know, that's absent of any kind of like head right. or arms or anything. It's just two eyes, a nose and a smile. It has kind of a wry smile somehow.
Yeah. No doubt it does. I mean, if you don't see smile on that, then you're blind. But and he and Ed are not that dissimilar. I mean, it's a very poppy. At times poppy, tongue in cheek sort of. I mean, the panda bears, the cocaine and the spider, the church signs.
Yeah,
it's. I mean, you can't take yourself too seriously to do stuff like that sometimes.
So it's a combination, I think, of their sense of humor and, mm-hmm. and also kind of that dark humor that comes from, you know, uncertainty, right? Yeah. Or maybe being misunderstood. And,
yeah.
and you know, Rob Pruitt very much comes from that place.
Yeah, I have a feeling, yeah, I think his, to me, and I haven't had this conversation with Ed, but Ed's upbringing was probably pretty solid. Right. I mean, he was versus what I can only imagine what Rob's was like. And then, mm-hmm. of course, getting older and understanding more about himself and having to face those realities at a time when people may or may not have been cool with that. So, I mean, Ed didn't have
yep.
that. But all the while, they both end up in this fucking amazing, fun place.
Yeah. And, you know, and Rob had really early success in the art world and then. You know, people kind of turned away from him, mm-hmm. and then he came back with success. So,
yeah.
The painting, I think, has a lot of meaning.
Yeah, good, good.
So, how do you live with art? So, do you look at it when you go from the bedroom to the shower? Do you look at it when you go down the stairs? Do you stop and think about it? Is it in your peripheral vision? How do you engage with
yeah,
it?
Yeah, well, that's when you have a home that's, we like to open our home up. So it could be a bigger event that we've done for the museum here, or it could be just a dinner party, whatever. There's always new people coming through that want to know. They're like, holy cow. First of all, they don't expect to see that type of art in my house. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they expect, but it's a surprise to them. So they're interested and they want a tour and they want to talk about it. And so that's really what happens most of the time. I mean, I walked upstairs to go put my shoes on to come go back downstairs to drive here. I didn't stop at all and you know, spend 30 seconds in front of the Banksy or 30 seconds in front of the Mark Ryden or in front of the Ed or the Raymond Pettibon. I just walked to my car. But it's cool when people come over. I love walking people through the house and talking about the art and talking about what it means to me. I mean, we've talked about this. I'm not a guy that I don't need to stand in front of a piece of art for 5 minutes. Be like, oh, I see it. Heidi, do you see it? Do you see what he's telling us? He or she is telling us. Like, I just can't. I like turn the corner. I'm like, that is badass. I have to have that.
So it's quick.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And none of it's, I would never buy a piece or collect a piece for, you know, for future value or for future trades. I'm not opposed to selling art, but if you look at it and you're like, I could never put that on my wall, but I know that it's going to be worth 10x in 5 years, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that's not for you.
No. And the worst thing is we have so much art, which I guess is the case when you're just like a serial collector. We have so much art in storage. It just sits in storage. I'm like, you forget about pieces. I have to go back through my spreadsheet. And I'm like, holy shit, I forgot about that piece. So it's a shame when things sit in crates and boxes and dark storage.
So when you were looking at that Raymond Pettibon, you shared that with me. And what did you like about that piece?
The
H-bombs?
Can you
describe it?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another one who's very dark. I mean, Raymond is or maybe it was the baseball. Was it the baseball?
The baseball one.
Okay,
uh-huh.
Yeah, because we have the two here in Aspen, the baseball player, which...
it's the newer one.
It's funny because I love the piece, but I don't like the color green. I don't like green at all. And I only really like brown. And it's mostly green and brown, but it's a baseball player. And so you, with him, if you can come across a baseball player or a surfer, you kind of got to get it. Mm-hmm. And so I actually love I have two other of his OG pieces. I've got the two girls with, you know, topless with the, you know, they're like Martians with the antennas out of their heads. And they said, we've come to steal Earth's H-bombs. And there's just these boobs out. And it's like, but... And that one, and I love putting that one like where I know there's going to be the most foot traffic in the house. Because it's sooner we get people to understand that this shit ain't going to be normal, the better. And so, but yeah, I prefer the OG ones. I've got another great one in Austin, the heart, a red heart about Shimmy Rock, Arkansas. They're both very small. And the baseball one, I just had to have, you know, because it's a baseball one.
So when the first time we really talked about
Have you ever been around Pettibon?
Yes.
The first time I had lunch with him with another artist named Gomez Bueno, and they had done some collaborations together. I don't know if I ever told you the story. We had lunch in Los Angeles, and for the listener, so Pettibon, and a lot of these guys, which I love just talking about, you know, Pettibon got his start doing album covers for punk bands, mm-hmm. So for Black Flag, et cetera, et cetera. Mark Ryden got his start. His first big break was a Michael Jackson record. He is a Pettibon is out there. He showed up to lunch and we had lunch, blah, 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 blah. I could tell he was out there. And then we go to leave and I see in his back pocket, he's got like 20 pages of a book that he had ripped out and were sort of folded over, tucked in his back pocket. And I said, what's going on with that? And he's like, he took the bus to lunch. I was going to take the bus back. He's like, this is kind of what I figured I could read. So he just, he's like, I think this is probably worth 20 pages at the time it's going to take to get to that lunch and get back. So he took out those 20 pages of the book. I mean, just carry the book.
Yeah.
Anyways, and I was like, all right, that just shows you what, I mean.
It's a different way of thinking.
Yeah, they just, they think differently than a lot of people.
So that's what you said the first time that we really talked about art. Because I said, you know, what do you like about art? And you said, well, artists take something that was nothing and make it something.
Right.
And you said, and that's what I did, you know, with the bike.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's, I mean, for me, it was I don't want to say it was relatively easy, but I knew what I was doing. I didn't have to, I mean, this, when I look at, I can't draw a stick figure. So when I see certain things, whether it's a, you know, a Hearst piece or a, you know, Ed's work is, I can see how Ed did that. There's different type of skill involved there, but you know, there's just a lot of other things like, now how did they do that again? Like, yeah. And I can't draw a stick figure, but how did they do that? And so when I see that, I love that. Rydin's a great example. I mean, the detail in his paintings is just, it's just next level.
So how do you think art has made your life better? Making the assumption that it has.
No, it has. Yeah, no doubt. I guess aside from having cool stuff that I get to walk past and look at and tell people about, I've met some amazing people. I mean, the between, you know, just, you know, and I think it's gotten a little bit carried away, but early days at Art Basel in Miami, meeting amazing artists, collectors, you know, gallery owners, just interesting people. And then our time here at the museum, being on the board, meeting all the people that come through this town. But that's probably the most important thing that's happened.
The connections.
That trip to Cuba was so crazy. We did this, the listener, we did this, I guess the museum does them every year. Most years they do a trip and they'll pick different places. And so that particular summer, the summer trip was to Cuba. And I'm like, hell yeah, a place I've always wanted to go. Not too far. Right. I don't want to be going to Australia or Zurich or any of these places where you get jet lagged, like close.
Yeah.
And, you know, that group that was on that trip was just, you know, was next level. I mean, people like Lester Smith and Paul Pariser and their spouses. I mean, it was just, and some, you know, what it's like when you got a group, there's always a couple bumps on the log, but yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was really fun. So do you have a thought about like the timeliness of art or the content? One of the things that you and I kind of bonded, I guess, on is public perception, mm-hmm. maybe, which is different than, you know, personal reality, right?
Always.
And always, yes.
Always.
And, you know, some of the kind of uncertainty that comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what my question is exactly, other than, has art served a role for you in that? So,
yeah,
solace maybe, or company?
Definitely company. I mean, you live with these pieces, and they live with you, and you're very proud of them. And obviously, the thing I'm most proud of are my five kids. But these are things that you're, and at this point, I mean, let's just be frank. I mean, I'm done paying people back. Financially, right? So I'm sort of playing offense in my own way again and making a living. And so I'm proud of the fact that, you know, I sold a lot of things to settle up a lot of legal issues, but I'm proud of the fact that, I sold one art piece, in the whole process. And so I'm proud of the fact that I was able to, I still have these beautiful pieces of work from these amazing artists that, you know, I think when an outsider looked at it at the beginning and maybe knew that art was there, they're like, huh, those will be gone.
Right.
And so, yeah, there's a house gone. There's two houses gone. There's an airplane gone. But you know what? I got a whole bunch of fucking Ed Richets. I got a whole bunch of Banksys. I got a whole bunch of Rydins. I got a whole bunch of Pettibones. And so it's like, I love that. Yeah. A bunch of Candés. Like,
yeah.
Didn't think twice about selling a house or an airplane. I just couldn't bring myself to sell art. Like it was the one thing. And at the height of uncertainty, I was like, dude, I got to do whatever I can to hold on to these pieces.
So interesting, you know, because, I mean, you know, I went through a divorce a couple years ago, and the only thing I cared about was my kids and my art. And it took a while to get it all back, but I ended up with all of it also.
Yeah.
So that was, this just wasn't a question.
Yeah, and by the way, it's great for your kids to be around. I mean, I love the, my kids don't ask a lot of questions about the art. The only thing they know is don't touch the art. Right. That's so funny. Their kids come over, I was like, hey, one rule, don't touch the art. But even if they don't ask questions, I think it's, you know, if I compare my kids to other kids, like their friends walk through homes that, I don't know, probably have a bunch of family photos.
Yeah.
Which is sweet too, but even if they don't ask questions about it, they are absorbing that work.
For sure.
And later in life, it will come back around.
Yeah. So Emerson, my son, took a graduation trip to Europe and, you know, all his
just
friends.
Just schooling these kids on art.
He made them all go to, you know, the Serpentine. And, you know, he took them to all these galleries and the other, you know, and there are these like jockey conservative kids, you know, and their moms all texted me like, oh, I'm so glad they're with Emerson because they would never have gone to any of these places. And, and, you know, whether he likes it or not, I can't say, you know, but he knows that it's important to take a look and he wanted to share that with his friends.
Well, he wouldn't, I don't think he would have gone and done that if he didn't like it.
Yeah.
He may not admit that he likes it, but it's cool.
So,
how about this building? Look at this light on this thing.
Right? Yeah. No. I don't know.
This is a piece of art.
This is definitely a piece of art.
We're talking about the actual building that we're in, which is the new-ish Aspen Art Museum, which moved out of what was like a, I don't know, railroad stop or something.
The first power plant west
of
the
power plant, whatever it was over there, that thing. Janky. But building this thing was, it was so neat to just see, talk about uncertainty, but just neat to see the city, not mostly, but enough, there was enough opposition that it was like, I just remember reading about it. It was in the paper every day and reading about it and the letters to the editor. And I'm just like, just wait. Like you people are going to be so proud of this when it's done. And I think it's, I think that's happened. I think that, yeah, there might be a few outliers, but I think, look what we got. With this thing, I mean, what do we have to raise to build this thing?
So,
a lot.
$75 million.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, what else?
Do you like to look at art with other people?
Well, how so? Like, I mean, if I go over to John Phelan's house and he wants to walk me around and look at his art, I would drop Nancy Magoon's house. You know, especially with Nancy Magoon is, she's just a legend. And so I've had so many artists that I know that have come through Aspen and been like, is there any way that you could take me up to Nancy's or I could go up there and look at her collection? I'm like, and they're like kids. Yeah. They're like nervous.
It's funny, right?
Yeah.
I'm having lunch with Nancy tomorrow. And you know what? It's funny. When I was on your podcast, it was, I think, the day after we had lunch with Nancy and Bob. Mm-hmm. And that was probably the last time you saw him.
Yeah, it was. He's a sweetheart. He lived a full life, you know?
I mean,
if you think about, and as long as he lived and as long as he was sort of really present, I mean, he loved to tell these stories. He would tell these stories of racing these speedboats from, I don't know, Miami to the Bahamas or Cuba or something. I'm like, you have these photos. I'm like, dude, you're crazy. No, what did they? What was the race? It was like up the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah, I think he went from Miami to New York. He held the world record.
Yeah, no, I'm out on that. No way. No thanks.
So, but that was one of the ways he liked to connect with you, you know, was that athleticism and competition and racing.
Oh, world record's a world record.
Right.
Yeah.
A world record is a world record.
That's not just, they don't just hand those out at Carl's Pharmacy. I mean, they're...
all right. What else? Should I ask you anything else?
Shit, I don't know. I mean, I'll talk about anything. I don't care. I'll talk about. What did you not ask me?
Okay, I'll ask you a question that's not about art, but okay. It's about uncertainty.
Yeah.
So what do you do to quiet your mind?
Oh, boy. My mind is not quiet often. I mean,
Me neither.
Yeah, my sort of special ninja skill is sleep. Like I love to sleep. I'm a good sleeper. I don't struggle to go to sleep. I don't struggle to stay asleep. Like I go, and honestly, in the middle of, you know, the last 7 years, like, because if you don't sleep, then you're tired. Then you have anxiety. Then it's just a vicious cycle. And so, I mean, I really, you know, and even not just the past 7 years. I mean, I remember I was diagnosed October 2nd, 1996. The doctor, so I was diagnosed at like 5 p.m. on October 2nd. And I say to the doctor, I'm like, whoa, hang on a second. Are you sure? And he's like, yeah, you have surgery at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. So at that point, I've got, you know, 14 hours. And so obviously the most stressful moment in my first 26 years. And I went home that night, called my mom, made dinner, went to bed, and fell straight asleep. And woke up the next day, drove to the hospital. But I went straight to sleep. I'm like, dude, I mean, I never struggled with sleep, but I'm like, now is the time. You got to rest. And it was the same the last 7 years. I'm like a sleep ninja. But when I'm up, it's go hard or go home. It's full gas. And so, and then I think, obviously, outside of sleep, the bike is really the thing that's quieted my mind the most. And interestingly enough, I mean, I grew up swimming and running and cycling and doing triathlon. And the only place, the quietest, I can get quiet-ish running and I can get quiet-ish swimming, but nothing compares to riding. Like when I got to be alone, if you're with other people and they're talking to you, and even if they're in your world, you can't get that quiet. But if you're alone, no music, no nothing, I get real quiet. And so between those two, that's kind of the sleep is the energy station, mm-hmm. and the bike is the therapy. Mm. And there's other therapy too. But it's the most consistent therapy.
And so, so after you've had that, like in the zone or the flow or whatever, do you feel recharged?
Completely. Yeah. And compare and contrast, if you don't get it, mm-hmm. then you feel, if I'm low on sleep and low on exercise, note to everybody listening, don't ever get around me.
You're grumpy.
It's a bad, you know, some people get grumpy when they're hungry,
yeah.
or whatever. Low on sleep, low on endurance exercise, bad, real bad. People tell me, dude, you need to go for a long bike ride.
See you later. So, are those, like when you're on the bike, where do you have ideas? So one of the things that...
On the bike, it's the best.
Also. Yeah. Okay. So that's like a creative space for you?
Yeah. Yeah. And the struggle becomes, and this is what I do. And even when I was younger, I mean, I had a way before phones or flip phones or any phone. I just had a voice recorder, a little voice recorder that because you get so much thought. You don't, obviously, you're on a bike. You don't have a notepad. You don't have an assistant. You don't have... all the devices we have now. So back then I would have this little dictaphone thing. It was small, but I had it in my pocket. I carried my jersey pocket. And now I can grab my phone and just send myself a voice memo, or now with these phones you can like voice dictate messages.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So but it just starts coming.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a mechanism to record it, you'll forget.
Right.
I mean, it may circle back around a day later or a week later, but fuck, man, I don't want to lose all of this thought that I'm out there generating. Mm-hmm. So I try to capture it that way.
What's the best idea you think you've ever had?
Ever?
Ever.
Ever? The yellow wristband. No, that wasn't my idea. The best idea I've ever had. God dang. Nobody's ever asked me that question. Oh, my Lord. Wow. And I don't get to come back to this one. I have to answer it. I mean, I mean, the best, I don't know if it's the best idea, but to, for me, you know, because I too started reimagining my life and my brand through this space, through the podcast space, creating content like we are doing right now. That started phase one of that, which is with the show that you were on, was a religiously non-cycling show. Mm-hmm. And it was for a reason. I mean, I hated cycling. I hated the sport. I hated the industry. I hated the governing body. I hated everything. And, you know, to one day wake up and go, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to turn around. And to go back into it, just run straight back into the fire and create content around that. I mean, from a business perspective and from a, you know, PR, I think when my life is done and they're telling the story, that decision will be the one where people go, holy shit, that's, he was having great conversations with interesting people like Heidi and Malcolm Gladwell and Michael Morton and Bo Jackson. But when he turned around and ran back into the fire, that was when the comeback really started. Mm-hmm. And so that was probably a guess. I mean, I'm sure I'm forgetting a lot of things, but yeah. I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in now without that decision.
Yeah. So did it take a lot of courage?
To turn around?
To come back in.
No, I mean, it was funny. I tried to, maybe it did. I tried to think of it as just sort of, you know, whatever. We'll just go do this, you know. And it really was, it was kind of a joke because I talked to my manager, who Mark Higgins, who's the guy who, the forward, my original podcast, was his idea. So when I called him, I was like, what if we just did a tour show? And he's like, all right, well, what's that look like? And he's like, you're not just going to sit there by yourself and talk about it. I was like, I don't know. Fuck, we got to find somebody else to talk with. I'll talk to. And JB has been an old friend of mine, and I knew, I was like, well, JB knows enough about cycling to be dangerous, has spoken to America in the sense of Main Street and First, his entire career being a morning DJ in Austin, mm-hmm. a pop music morning DJ, which really is speaking to First in Maine. I'm like, well, let's just get JB. And so I just kind of was like, fuck all this, we'll fucking make it up as we go along. And I was like, JB's got that Airstream studio. Just tell him to drive it up here. I mean, it was this is exactly how it happened.
I remember.
And so I was maybe just giving myself cover. I mean, look, there could have been six people that listened. But we just took this. We had no pressure. We had no expectation. We just wanted to have fun. We were totally irreverent and raw and honest and. Instead of six, it was 6 million.
Yeah, super authentic.
Yeah, yeah. Very. I mean, but by the way, I don't work for anybody.
No, I know. Well, and so, you've always been, I mean, that's who you are, you know?
Yeah. And that's, and then I tell people all the time, like, I wouldn't trade this, what I'm going to go home to tonight. So what are we, you know, September of 2009. I wouldn't trade it for any day ever in my life, ever. And I've had some highlights and some big times and some good times. And so, you know, we're on a path here that's fun, that's really, really, really fucking authentic. I had a conversation with a nonprofit today and I don't get a lot of calls from nonprofits wanting me to work and to be on their board and to whatever. But this is a cool young Colorado-based nonprofit. And the Lance of 10 years ago would have just said, yeah, I'll do it. And I said, let me, you know, they're doing an event here in Aspen coming up. I said, let me come by. Let me just sort of walk around and just sort of shadow the thing. I said, because man, at this point, like I can't just say yes. And then I get in and I'm like, why did I say yes? Like I have to show up and shadow and watch this and be moved. And if I'm not moved, I have to tell you no.
It's so interesting because just 2 days ago, I started to say no.
Mm-hmm. No is a big deal. Well, people say yes too often.
And no, not just to prove that you can say no. You know?
Because there's that.
And that's not what this is. Mm-hmm. This is like an authentic, I don't know, I don't want to overuse that word, but this is a no because it just doesn't serve me.
You know? No, it protects you.
Yeah.
No, you are protecting yourself and your time. What are you, 31? Somebody asked me, why don't you ever want to hang out with that person? I said, well, I'm 48. I've been through a ton of shit. So I get to decide now. I know exactly what I want to do and don't want to do. And I also get to decide who I hang out with, who I don't hang out with, what I say, what I don't say. Dude, I mean, that is the most powerful position you can come from. And I agree with you. Because a lot of people abuse this and people write books about saying no. And it just comes off, well, I'm just going to watch this. I'm just going to say no to this person. Like it's a protection mechanism, but there's also, it has to be done thoughtfully. Mm-hmm. And that's what I try to say to this guy. He's like, look, this all sounds awesome. But man, I just love to spend a couple of days and just see if it moves me. And it sounds like it will. But maybe not, because you just can't. And that's what I tell the audience, and my audience now is like, what you're gonna get the 100% truth on anything, all the way down to. And we talked about this. I mean, the people we align ourselves with, the advertisers we take on. I mean, this is I think my audience is really sensitive and loyal now. You know, if I started jamming them with, you know, ads for, you know, razor blades and underwear and legal advice, they'd be like, this guy is so full of shit. So all of it has to be authentic.
So I don't know when you said this, but at some point you said or wrote that there are only two kind of days, good days and great days.
Right. That was after I was diagnosed.
Yeah. Well, I think I read that before I knew you.
Yeah.
And I just internalized it, you know, and then I talked to my kids about it. Mm-hmm. And then they've talked to their friends about it. And it's what I was thinking about when you said, you know, today's the perfect day. Right. So,
yeah, I mean, I think had I not been, so that statement or quote came after I was diagnosed and cured and back to reality, sport and life and family. Without that period of my life, so that call it a year of diagnosis, treatment, follow-up, it's really like a 2-year period there where you're just like, oh, am I going to live or am I going to die? What's the deal? Without that 2-year period, like the last 7 years, I might have been curled up. Mm-hmm. And I might have been begging for mercy. And I might have been hooked on oxys and homeless. I mean, I don't know. So for that, I'm very thankful that I went through that experience. I mean, the last 7 years, there's been times that completely sucked, but relative to, you know, 96 and 97, mm-hmm. no, It hasn't been that bad.
So how do you make decisions?
Well, it depends on what the decision is.
Right.
I think I base a lot of my decisions on the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a, it's interesting because now I now have this new venture fund that we have to make a lot of decisions. We have to decide what we invest in, who we invest in. My early thought was that it was always product first, people second, brand third. I saw an interesting talk here, actually in Aspen, from a very successful venture capitalist who came out of, you know, he now has a big fund in Boulder called Foundry. But he's been in VC for a long time. And so they've all, I think it's fluctuated over time on like, what do you prioritize? And he said an interesting thing. He said at Foundry, we, this guy's name was Brad. Before we invest in a company, we consider four things. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be good.
Yeah.
And he goes, the first thing is the people. The second thing is the people. The third thing is the people. Hmm. And the fourth thing is the idea. Which for me, and at that time, I was essentially idea first, product mm-hmm. first. Because mm-hmm. from an athlete standpoint, if the product fails, then we are done.
Mm-hmm.
And we are. And then we get to the people. And then you get to the brand and the marketing, messaging, the story. But you got to base most of your decisions on people, right? And frankly, I mean, I've made a lot of the mistakes in my life have been based on my own actions, of course, mostly. But people I've been around.
Yeah.
And not that they were bad.
Right.
But they weren't helping me make the best decisions. And so the good news is when your world just gets eviscerated, all the people leave, most of the people leave, and then you're left with like, you look around and you're like, whoa, who the fuck are you? You're left with really smart, loyal people that are committed to you that you can then play offense and make smart decisions.
Good.
And it's true. I mean, it's actually really true. That's exactly how it happens.
Conversations About Art is part of HiZ.art. This episode was produced by Simon Illa with sound recording and technical assistance by Simon Klein. Our theme music was composed by Eric McDougall. Jordan Weisberg is our curatorial associate. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and review us on whichever platform you listened, as it helps us further our goal of connecting all to art. We'll be back again every other Tuesday with new episodes. Thanks so much for listening. I'm grateful for your time and attention.